You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 23rd of January 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, the lights are back on in Washington, but for how long?
The Republican majority now has 17 days to prevent the Dreamers from being deported.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer leaves the ball in the GOP's court, but with no meaningful breakthrough, have the Democrats ceded to Republican demands? My guests Xenia Wickett and Quentin Peel will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including India's Narendra Modi takes to the stage in Davos with a warning that globalization is under threat, the return of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and one of France's favourite dogs, the Barbet, is now a pedigree breed, according to Britain's Kennel Club. Is it another sign of cozier diplomatic relations, or are we barking up the wrong tree? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are indeed Xenia Wickett, head of US and the Americas programme and dean of the Queen Elizabeth II Academy at Chatham House, and Quentin Peel, contributor and former correspondent at the Financial Times. Welcome both to the programme. Very good to have you with us this evening. Now, the US government may be back up and running, but many fear it may have come at some price and at the expense of the Democrats, indeed. Polls in the state suggest almost 9 out of 10 Americans support the right of Dreamers, the children of undocumented migrants, to remain in the country. The Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says the GOP's promised to consider some kind of immigration legislation, but critics say the Democrats have sold out the Dreamers in exchange for only the vaguest of promises. Xenia Wickett, is that how you read this? Is it a sellout?
I wouldn't say it's a sellout. I would say the following. The Democrats who doubt that the Republicans will follow through on their promise to actually have a debate about the Dreamers, about DACA, which is the other way of kind of expression for them, are absolutely right. I don't see, you know, McConnell kind of having a real debate, even if McConnell does allow a real debate in the Senate about what do we do about the Dreamers. It's very unlikely that Paul Ryan in the House will actually move an agenda forward on this issue. So, you know, those who doubt the promise that has been given to move forward this issue are absolutely right. On the other hand, is it a sellout? It's really, really hard to persuade American voters in an election year, albeit a midterm, that it is a sensible balance to shut down the government for non-voters, immigrants who are coming to the country. And so, you know, essentially Schumer was in, and the Democrats were in this kind of untenable position of saying, we're going to shut down the American government, which is supposed to run this country because of this group that aren't Americans, you know, and still expect to actually get support. So, I mean, they were in an inherently problematic position. So on the one hand, the Republicans really aren't going to follow through, I don't anticipate. On the other hand, they'd gotten themselves into an untenable position that was really very hard to move forward. Eventually, the reality is that they will sort out the Dreamers, and they'll sort out the Dreamers because unless the Republicans find a way to sort out the Dreamers, the Republicans are going to start losing election after election after election, because who's the, you know, largest growing demographic in the United States? Well, I hate to say it, but it's, you know, the Hispanics. So they're going to have to sort this one out.
And Quentin, you got, I mean, obviously Chuck Schumer being sort of made the figurehead of this, as one might be expected. You know, he's the minority leader. And a lot of people saying, well, hang on, despite the backdrop that Xenia describes quite correctly there, what is the job of the minority leader? Should he be a deal maker, doing what's expedient in party political terms or into governmental terms? Or does he need to be, you know, an advocate of progressive values? That's what he's there to do. Is that the wrong question to be asking at this point?
Well, he's obviously got to have a clear position that isn't the administration's position. But I do wonder, and indeed listening to Xenia, whether he didn't actually dig the wrong hole, if you like, that he maybe chose the wrong issue on which to bring the entire machinery of government to a standstill. Having said which, I always watch these things with some amazement. I mean, it says government brought to a standstill sort of idea, and you wonder, well, actually, did anybody notice? I mean, some of the parks may be closed and so on, but it sounds like all the really serious bits of government actually do keep going during this. So I wonder if it isn't all a little bit overhyped, but nonetheless, I think that the Democrats are in a difficult position. They, everything ought to be going their way more than it is, because after all, there is Donald Trump apparently making ghastly blunder after blunder, and yet not in total meltdown yet.
And therein actually, you know, lies the problem at some level, because on both the Republican and the Democratic side, you don't have coherent halts. So the Democrats are absolutely split. And one of the problems that they had in this particular case was that you had a number of Democrats, those that are likely to run for the presidency in another 3 years, who were absolutely adamant that the government should shut down and that we should hold out for some progress on the Dreamers. And you had others who were fighting for their seats later this year in states that went for Donald Trump, who didn't want to shut down the government for essentially for immigrants. And so you've got a split on the Democratic side, you've got a split on the Republican side, and this is the problem, of course, that Paul Ryan in the House has, because, you know, he's determined to pass policy with Republican majorities rather than partner with the Democrats. And the Republicans are not unified on this or pretty much any issue, in fact. And this is why government in the United States right at the moment is so dysfunctional, because you don't have, you know, kind of coherent party lines. You've got cacophony.
It is quite extraordinary that you've got a Republican majority in both houses of Congress and a Republican president, and yet still they couldn't just get the budget through.
And they couldn't get it through because we shouldn't be calling them a Republican majority. They have, you know, they have split parties on both sides. It's not a single party.
Well, Zanny, I wanted to ask you a bit about that with a sort of recent bit of history, because, of course, we had a government shutdown. Well, there's been various threats. I think Obama, was it in 2013 there was one?
2013.
And am I right in saying in the Clinton administration there were a couple?
I think there was one in Clinton as well.
But was George W. Bush there? There was not one. Is that right?
No.
Now, explain to me the dynamics of that. We understand that we've got dysfunctionality all across the spectrum, but I guess some from without will pick up on exactly that point Quentin made and say, well, how come now? Surely this is the one time when this can't have been allowed to happen.
I don't know why this is the one time that this can't have been allowed to happen. I mean, if you look at, you know, if you want to look at trends, look at the trend over the last really 60 years. There's some absolutely fascinating statistics and charts you can look at. But essentially, it shows that in Congress, the most liberal Republican is now still to the right of the most conservative Democrat. 10 years ago, there was a little overlap. 50 years ago, there was a lot of overlap. And so what you've got today is essentially the Republicans and the Democrats do not overlap at all in policy terms. Their votes in Congress do not overlap. They've been swung so much, and you know, again, even further after the 2016 election, they've been swung far right, far left, and never the twain shall meet. And if you've got people who are absolutely adamant about their policies, who are not willing to compromise, then trying to get business done is very hard. I mean, I can probably name on one hand the senators who are willing to compromise, who are willing to work across the aisle, and it's always the same people.
Hmm. So, Quentin, given that backdrop of this ever more polarised sort of political spectrum, it still seems to me that, and both these parties on either side, riven by their own internal conflicts and disagreements, it still seems this is being painted as a more damaging day, if you like, and a more damaging issue for the Democrats than the GOP. Is that purely because Trump's in the White House and the Republicans control the Congress?
I suppose it's partly because those who want the Democrats to stand up and be counted are feeling very frustrated that they didn't. And I think they are feeling frustrated because it's a so-called Republican in the White House and they can't quite work out, one, still can't work out how on earth he got there and can't work out how on earth he can stay there because he's such a denial of everything that a traditional politician would stand for. But it is a very, very partisan, as we've seen in other countries, in Britain, very partisan politics, parties very split. Of course, in America, don't let's forget, when one talks about far left in America, it's somewhere around the middle of the political spectrum in European terms. Yeah. Neither of these parties could remotely be described as left wing in European terms. So we've got a very strange position where the middle ground of politics seems to be shredding and there's nothing to go in its place.
So to that point then, with obviously midterms ahead and, you know, it seems 2020 is approaching faster than anyone could have really imagined, does this all add up to... Well, what does this all add up to at the ballot box in the US? Because I know we should give up second-guessing given what happened in 2016, but can we read into what may happen, both at the midterms, but particularly in 2020?
I think that's a little premature. We're one year in. I mean, the thing that I would say is, you know, when Trump was elected, an awful lot of people, both Democrats and Republicans, said 4 years. You know, and I sat then and I sit here today saying, you know what? Don't reckon on 4 years. This could be 8 years. I mean, you know, Trump is... you know, there's a wonderful quote, you know, that he gave, calling himself a stable genius or something along those lines. Mm. He has been really, really good at the politics. I mean, you can question him all you like, but he's played the politics really rather well. And so, you know, you look at, yes, he's got the lowest approval ratings of any president at this point, any recent president at this point in his term. On the other hand, the people who voted for him, middle America, still support him just as much as they did because he is following through on many of his promises to them. So, you know, the idea that, you know, you can already start saying, well, you know, clearly, you know, he's a flash in a pan and he's gone, I think is way too premature. Equally, you know, if you look at the midterms for this year, they are really going to matter. Because I think it really does matter whether the Democrats take either the Senate or the House. I think that's pretty important from the Democratic perspective. Can they do it? It's going to be really, really hard for them to do it in the Senate just because there are so many Senate seats that are up for the Democrats and far fewer ones for the Republicans that are at risk. But they may well do it in the House.
And let us not forget, it's the economy, stupid. And hey, the economy is actually doing very nicely. Maybe still not for the left behinds. And that, I think, is going to be Trump's problem. Yep. That actually his constituency is not going to feel much benefit of the sort of protectionism and so on he's introducing. But having said that, generally, the economy is doing very well. And so on both sides of the Atlantic, there is this curious thing where the economy is doing well, but the politics are all over the place.
Well, we'll come back to trade and protectionism in a moment or two, but I wanted to focus on a gathering of celebrities capturing headlines over the next few days. Not the Golden Globes, not the Oscars. Quentin, I know you wanted to talk about that briefly, but this gathering is rather buried in snow. The World Economic Forum, of course, has rolled into the Alpine town of Davos. Elton John's there, Kate Blanchett, amongst others. But it's not all fun and games. The event indeed began today with a rather stark warning from India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi that globalization itself is under attack. Zenya Wicket, interesting that Modi struck that kind of note. Is it a problem for the World Economic Forum broadly that there's no shortage of world leaders and inspirational types to go and make those sorts of pronouncements? But it's what follows that where the wheels sort of come off somewhat.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, the Davos has been going for... two decades, perhaps more than that now. And the real challenge that they have, and they readily admit that they have, is how do you take what is a big confab, you know, in late January and actually, you know, with some really interesting conversations and actually take some real lessons, some real actions out of it to change. So it is, you know, wonderful that Modi has stood up and said, you know, we've got a real problem. Well, we knew that. The question is, what do we do about it? You've got lots of leaders, whether they're leaders from culture, business, NGOs, academia, think tanks, governments. These are the people who have the power to affect change, allegedly. What are they doing about it? And the trouble is you see very little come out. And so no great surprise that then those of us who you know, are watching this going on and kind of the people who don't allegedly have that power kind of say, well, you know, do you have a right?
And Quentin, does remarks like Modi's, does that kind of set the mood, set the tone at all for an event like the World Economic Forum? I mean, obviously, we've got Donald Trump himself is supposedly still to arrive later in the week. Does that set the mood, or will it be one of the things where these other leaders and influencers arrive very much with their own agenda to pronounce?
I think the days of Davos are effectively over. This is there's an awful feel of the moment of great joy with globalization, and now we're questioning it much more. But you have a situation now where Narendra Modi, it's like two completely alternative bookends. Narendra Modi comes in and says, globalization is under threat. There are all this terrible protectionists growing indeed in the developed world. And who's coming at the end but the arch exponent of that protectionism in the developed world, i.e. Donald Trump. And it's as if Davos is caught between those two bookends and I think has got very little sense of direction as to where they really want to go. Of course, let us not forget one thing. Narendra Modi is doing this. Why? Because Xi Jinping dominated the headlines last year, and that really infuriated the Indians.
And it's interesting, isn't it, Zanya? I think that the overall sort of theme, to whether or not Modi goes along with this, is creating a shared future in a fractured world. Now, again, it's talking a good game, but I mean, is Quentin onto something there? Does the World Economic Forum broadly and gatherings, I guess, like Davos, do they need to sort of set this? Do they need to change their almost their sort of raison d'etre and say, look, we're going to be a doer rather than just a talker about her.
Exactly. If we've learned nothing over the last two or three years, we should have learned that actually just getting together and having, you know, expensive food, expensive flights, you know, elitist groups isn't really going to make the people happy. And so, you know, unless Davos and other such organisations actually figure out how to translate their talk into action, they are going to, you know, as Quentin says, they're going to be history. And that's the real step. And that's, by the way, I mean, that's extraordinarily hard to do. But you have the right people in the room. You have 3,000 odd people, all of whom have, you know, power in some form or another. And if they can't figure out how to stop talking and actually start doing, then there's a real problem. Because, as I say, if we've learned nothing in the last few years, we've got to start doing.
But isn't precisely the election of Donald Trump and the vote for Brexit in Britain and the rise of more populist nationalism in other places precisely a rejection of Davos people? It is a rejection of these glitterati who are all seen as hugely wealthy, taking themselves off to this highly elite little resort, admittedly locked up in the snow, and I think perhaps not attracting quite as much attention as they have in the past, but they all desperately want to be there. And I think that's what the backlash is all about.
And doing nothing, which is why it's, you know, I mean, I think it is all about what they then do. Because if they actually achieved something concrete, I think people would live with it, would accept it. But at the moment, it's a talk shop and there doesn't seem to be terribly much that comes out of it.
I go along with you completely, but part of me wonders, is this not then precisely the moment to gather these sorts of individuals amongst that rarefied atmosphere to talk about the big challenges and maybe try and move the agenda on, to talk about exactly why even where they're sat is sort of under threat? Isn't it an error to think, well, actually, the days of this are gone. I guess when you're asking that question, it makes me feel like that's the very time you need to be having more of those kinds of conversations.
Well, I don't know. I'd like to see these people not going off to Davos to lock themselves up in these hotel ballrooms and things, but rather to get out there and look at the substance of the problem in the declining industrial areas of the developed world, but equally in the areas of the developing world that are simply not getting a look in globalization and global growth.
And what let me just add one point, which is, you know, so it has the potential to be an echo chamber. That, you know, if you bring together lots of people of a similar type, they're going to hear what they want to hear. And again, if we've learned nothing else in the last few years, we need to actually bring new voices into it. Now, to give Davos its due, I am sure that they are bringing, you know, making strong attempts to bring new voices.
But if those new voices are Elton John and Cate Blanchett, I mean, presumably
that's a new voice.
That's designed to get what? Keep the seasoned newspaper men like yourself, Quentin, interested. What's the point?
That's not the new voice. You need to get young people. You need to get minorities. You need to get people from different backgrounds. You really need to build the diversity. And to be fair, I'm sure that Davos at some level is trying to do that. But I'm not, as somebody who isn't in Davos this week, I can't tell you how well they succeeded.
And I fear that the media is playing the game. You know, we put the pictures of Cate Blanchett on the front page or whatever, and we pay attention. And I think we're not asking tough enough questions either, actually, of this, the world of Davos.
Well, I'm glad we were doing it on the programme today, Quentin. Let's return to this idea of trade and protectionism, which we touched on briefly earlier. After becoming one of the early casualties of Trump's ascent to the White House, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is back on track, although minus the US. Australia, Canada and Japan are just some of the 11 nations set to sign to a revised agreement in March after a couple of days of talks in Tokyo. Xenia, on one level, this is quite a positive story. TPP back on track. It's good that we're talking about people coming together to talk trade. But without the United States, again, this is rendered, if not meaningless, it's sort of empty somehow.
So I think it's far from meaningless. I think the fact that in the absence of the United States, Japan in particular, but others too, were able to continue to move the TPP agenda forward and in large part come to an agreement is fairly close to what it was with the United States. So, I mean, that took huge negotiations to do that, to get as far as they did. I think that is absolutely tremendous. And it really does send a message that these kind of agreements are still valued and still valuable. It also, and I think this is probably one of the factors that drove it, I think it is also a message to the United States that somewhere down the line, if America wants to buy in again, you know, that opportunity is available to them, unless, of course, they leave it too long. But I think that is extraordinarily important. And in fact, you know, again and again, you know, we've seen President Trump dismiss some really strategic and important agreements that have held true for long periods of time in some cases. I mean, TPP is a new one, but, you know, the value of NATO, the value of NAFTA, et cetera, et cetera. And the answer to that is really to lay the groundwork so that when America changes again, there is a space for America to re-engage. And I think that's what they've done. And I think that's extraordinarily important, both with and without the United States.
So, Quentin, potentially the sort of opportunity for the US to re-engage later. But I just wonder, even in the short term, is this something that the US, perhaps in the post-Trump era, whether that's in 2020 or even 2024, heaven forfend, will be living to regret?
Yes, I think I'm no doubt at all. I mean, even if this isn't dramatic in the short term, but actually it's a very interesting collection of countries that were brought together. After all, quite as well as Japan, you've got both Canada and Mexico, i.e. the two other members of NAFTA, in there. That may cause some stresses and strains, actually, within NAFTA if they're a member of a trade agreement that the Americans aren't. You've got Chile and Peru, and you've got then Malaysia and Vietnam and so on. So a really interesting collection of countries reducing their tariffs and improving their trade. Part of it was, of course, to have an alternative to the rise of China. And what we've seen in almost simultaneously with this is Donald Trump taking on China alone, if you like, by slapping on tariffs now on solar panels and on, was it, washing machines?
Washing machines, yeah.
And fairly arcane bit of legislation. Now, he's taking on China a bit all alone. It'll be very interesting to see how the TPP countries now actually open up relations themselves with China.
And Zonia, to that point that Quentin makes about the specific sort of areas that Trump's targeted, again, he's sort of doing what he said he would do. So in that sense, we shouldn't be surprised. We also know that it will play very well with large elements, at least, of his base, as we describe it. But is he making a strategic mistake looking at these areas in particular? And it does seem rather to have China in the sort of crosshairs.
So, this is a personal health view, but yes, I think he is. There's no question, America has long considered itself an Asia-Pacific power. It continues to consider itself an Asia-Pacific power. There's absolutely no question that stability in that area is of vital interest and vital importance to the United States, whether you're talking about the rise of China, whether you're talking about the huge demographics in India and China and Indonesia, whether you're talking about North Korea. There's no question that America is still very invested in that region. And to essentially kick out one of the most important legs of America's engagement in that region, which is to say an economic and trade engagement in that region, makes absolutely no sense whatsoever.
And Quentin, very briefly, and perhaps erroneously to bring Brexit in here, but there's a lot of talk here and I guess in Brussels too about, what are the sort of trade deals that can be done, and certainly those that back Brexit, been sold an untruth in the idea that we can re-strike new and exciting trade deals globally. Does this hint at the fact that possibly that could happen, but it's still going to be less good than just sticking in the customs union?
There's
as
a fundamental truth about trade deals, which is that geographic proximity works best. So what you don't do is actually put up barriers or reduce your access to your closest neighbours in order to get wonderful new markets in, for the British case, in Australia or New Zealand or the other side of the world. So there is a fundamental problem for the Brexit drive in that the replacing the European Union with these much smaller and more distant markets isn't great. And of course, the most important of all is the United States. And that's the one country that is actually going to be really difficult to negotiate a trade deal with, because they're going to be very tough and saying, we get what we want. You've got to damn well accept our chlorine washed chicken or our, or our beef with hormones in it, because that's what the rest of Europe won't do. And I'm not sure the Brits are going to like it.
Possibly not. Probably not, in fact. Finally today, though, already this month, France has agreed to loan Britain the historic biotapestry. There's been the suggestion, outlandish though it may have been, of a bridge spanning the Channel. Whatever next. But like the lovesick Pepe Le Pew, locked in a constant pursuit of his feline friend, the diplomatic warmth doesn't end there. Today, Britain's Kennel Club announced that the Barbet may now be considered a pedigree breed by its own exacting standards. Quentin, this is an exciting breakthrough for followers of this sort of canine detail. This is the sort of thing, though, that does it matter ever more as we've got ourselves into this scrape with our friends across the Channel?
It is quite extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, I love the photos of this wonderful dog. It's about the scruffiest, hairiest, wildest looking dog you've ever seen. Something a bit like an Irish Water Spaniel. And the idea that, we're going to embrace this as a new breed. Actually, I rang up a couple of French friends before coming on the programme and said, we're going to see this. And they said, what? What dog is that? We don't know we've got any dogs like that. Apparently it's been around since the 18th century and it was rather a good gun dog and so on. Anyway, great gesture. So what we've done, did you see that wonderful tweet during the week? It was that picture of Emmanuel Macron talking to Angela Merkel, and both of them giggling. She's giggling so much she's got her hand in front of her face, and the words that somebody's put in their mouths, and Macron saying to Merkel, well, you see, I asked her for 40 billion euros and I said I would lend her the Bayeux tapestry in exchange, and do you know what? She said yes. So they can't quite believe that the Brits are falling over themselves to actually make nice just because of Brexit.
I have to say, you know, it is a sad state of diplomacy when...
We had panda diplomacy before.
I know.
When
we are falling to the level of... And don't get me wrong, I love dogs, but falling to the level of referencing the Kennel Club's acceptance of the Barbet.
But I think I heard Xenia say that she's a bit worried. I don't think she wants her husband to see pictures of these dogs because he rather wants a dog in the house.
Indeed.
They're handsome beasts. And apparently they're so enthusiastic about plunging into the water, they'll do it, come up where they'll jump literally through ice. So they're very brave and hardy. I don't know what to read into that.
Probably nothing. What's going to happen when they come to Crufts and they have to walk in precise mincing fashion down
We can look forward to that. When is Crufts? Put it in the diary, Quentin. That brings us to the end of today's programme. My thanks to Quentin Peel and Xenia Wickett. Thank you both for joining us. Today's programme was produced by Ben Ryland, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and James Kitchen. And our studio manager was Christy Evans. Music for you next, Section D at 1900, and more on the big stories of the day on The Daily at 2200. Thanks for listening.